Joining us now live is former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter. He is no stranger to controversy. He argued when he left UNSCOM that UNSCOM was a nest of US spies and that Iraq was disarmed a long time before the war. He was Time magazine's Person of the Week in September of 2002, and he also has written extensively about his views and experiences, including a book called Frontier Justice, Weapons of Mass Destruction and the Bushwhacking of America. Scott Ritter, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Before we get into your ideas, do you have any comment on the previous guest that we had and his ideas on South Africa with regard to the removal of nuclear weapons before a black government took hold?
Well, that's my understanding. The nuclear weapon was developed by the white supremacist government of South Africa as a last-ditch weapon to prevent black guerrilla groups from taking over. Once a rapprochement had been reached with the blacks and the days of apartheid and white supremacy were numbered, the decision was made that these weapons must be declared and brought under international control to prevent them and their related technologies from falling in the hands of any black-dominated government.
So what of there's another government which recently publicly disarmed Algeria, and of course the Bush administration claims that the war in Iraq is one of the main factors in that. What of the role of the Europeans, and why did Algeria disarm, and do we know in fact that it has?
Do you mean Libya?
Excuse me, Libya, of course.
Okay, yeah, because I was going to say Algeria.
No, the Algerians don't have that caliber of weapon yet.
Not yet.
So Muammar Gaddafi, he came out and publicly embraced this whole disarmament thing. And what do you think was behind that? Was it the war in Iraq, or were there other things going on that were not as public?
No, there were other things going on that weren't quite as public. Look, Libya had been on the blacklist of Europe and the United States and the international community for some time, since the Lockerbie bombing. And the government of Muammar Gaddafi was desperate to have these sanctions lifted and was working very aggressively in that direction. They had surrendered suspects for international trial and had agreed to make reparation payments to the victims of the Lockerbie bombing, but there needed to be one final gesture that had to be made to bring the United States over to where the American government would support the lifting of sanctions. And Libya had for some time been nurturing visions of weapons of mass destruction. That was back when Libya was in its isolationist mode or regional dominance mode. Right now, I think Muammar Gaddafi has a much more realistic appreciation of the limits of his power and is desirous of regaining economic viability. And so he was willing to give up these programs, which had never amounted to much. There was high-quality technology, good designs, but there were no viable programs per se. They were costing Libya a lot of money. Libya wasn't going to go forward with these programs. So it was really a freebie. He just threw it out there so that he could get the sanctions lifted. The time was right. The United States was desperate for some sort of diplomatic breakthrough, and Libya took advantage of it. So I think that this was more a result of Libyan the wisdom of the Libyan leader, if you can say that about Gaddafi, the persistence of European diplomacy, which had paved the way for this, and the desperation of the Bush administration, which under normal circumstances might not have accepted the Libyan the Libyans reaching out in the manner they did, but because of Iraq, needed a diplomatic breakthrough.
Now, of course, when it comes to nuclear and chemical and biological weapons, one thing that is often overlooked is the ability to deliver them. In the case of Libya, I'm not aware that they had any intercontinental missiles that could deliver those weapons. Do we know if they did? And we'll move on then from there to Iraq, and whether Iraq had any missiles that could cover long distances.
Well, the Libyans did have and do have Russian Scud missiles. The Scud C missile is a short-range missile.
Does that qualify as an ICBM?
Well, an ICBM, that's an intercontinental ballistic missile. However, Libya's in Africa, the continent of Africa. With the right modifications, it could strike Europe. That makes it an intercontinental ballistic missile. Mm-hmm. It's all the perspective of who's on the receiving end of the missile. The Libyans were working for an extended-range version of this missile back in the late 1980s. In fact, they had reached out to Iraq, and there was the beginnings of a cooperation with Iraq for the Iraqi government to extend the range of Libyan missiles. The Gulf War brought an end to that program, and there was no resumption of it. But, you know, we speak of the delivery of weapons. I have to disagree to some extent with some of the comments made by your previous guest about, you know, the ease in which nation states and non-nation states, terrorist groups, can acquire weapons of mass destruction. Nuclear weapons simply cannot be manufactured with the simple acquisition of fissile material. What a ludicrous statement to make. There is so much more involved, including shaping the fissile core to the precise size, manufacturing high explosive lenses with zero defects, because if you have even one minute deformity, you don't get an explosion, you get a fizzle. Chemical and biological weapons are extremely difficult to manufacture. Chemical weapons, of course, the crude variant, similar to what was used in World War I during the Iran-Iraq War, can be manufactured. I can make one using chlorine gas that's found in the average swimming pool here in the United States. But advanced chemical weapons, the VX, the sarin, that's very difficult to do. The sarin nerve agent that was manufactured by the Japanese terrorist groups wasn't that effective. It didn't kill that many people, even when it was used in an enclosed environment such as the Tokyo subway. And let's never forget, that same Japanese terrorist group attempted to manufacture biological weapons. You just can't make biological weapons in a home laboratory. You might be able to isolate the bacterium associated with botulinum or anthrax, but the ability to mass produce them, to concentrate them, and to keep them alive, to keep them viable, these are things that only the most advanced scientific nations have ever been able to perfect. That is why more nations have nuclear weapons programs than they do viable biological weapons programs. Biological weapons are amongst the most difficult to make.
And of course, some of that comes down again to delivery. You said the use of the sarin gas in the subways in Tokyo didn't kill as many people as had initially been feared, and I guess that was partly due to very ineffective means of delivery.
Well, it was due to the ineffective means of delivery, but it's also the viability of the agent itself. And I think what we'll find is, like, let's just take Iraq, for instance. They mm-hmm. did not build a viable biological weapon. They never did. They took liquid bulk agent, which is useless, and put it into a warhead, and the only way that warhead could kill you is if it landed on top of you, because if it missed you and hit the ground next to you, it would just break open and the liquid would seep into the earth. That liquid only becomes viable if it's turned into an aerosol, 0.3 to 0.5 microns in size, that you inhale, and then you could be affected by the anthrax. But the Iraqis never developed an aerosolized variant. They never developed a dry-powdered variant. They never developed a biological weapon. They made agent, but they never made a weapon.
Now, and you've made the point in the past that these agents that they had developed, especially the liquid form, had a very limited shelf life, and that shelf life had been exceeded to a large extent by the mid-90s, before the start of this war. I wanted to ask you about the intelligence. You know, a lot has been made of the so-called failure of the intelligence agencies, and some people have still expressed some faint possibility that weapons will be found. Of course, you know, President Bush and John Kerry both voted for this war to some extent, and they appeared to have been in agreement on it. Were we being the general public, misled by both parties equally, and to what extent should we hold the intelligence community responsible for all this? Because it seems to me like several people, yourself included, knew that we weren't going to find anything.
Well, look, the CIA knew we weren't going to find anything.
Even though George Tenet described it as a slam dunk case, right?
But George Tenet, was playing politics, wasn't playing in the responsible, wasn't carrying out his responsibilities as the director of Central Intelligence to tell the truth. He was serving as a politically motivated facilitator of American policy objectives. And that's what we have to remember. The policy of the United States has not been at any time the disarmament of Iraq, especially since 1991. As soon as the resolutions calling for Iraq's disarmament were passed. And keep in mind, they were linked to the maintenance of economic sanctions. We had Secretary of State, then Secretary of State James Baker, stating unequivocally that sanctions will not be lifted until which time Saddam Hussein is removed from power, even if the Iraqi government complies with its disarmament obligation. That is July 1991. Mm-hmm. October 1991, then-President George Herbert Walker Bush repeats that statement and then signs a covert finding ordering the CIA to use whatever means necessary, including lethal means, to remove Saddam from power. The CIA's fundamental task from 1991 until 2003 was the elimination of Saddam Hussein. What we've seen here is not an intelligence failure. It's a disgrace for democracy. It's a disgrace for a law-abiding people. But it was an intelligence success. The CIA accomplished its mission, and one of the key aspects of its mission was maintaining the public perception that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction that represented a threat to international peace and security, and therefore legitimized the continuation of economic sanctions. This was the CIA's mission, and they accomplished it. They lied to American politicians when the American politicians needed lying to. There were other American politicians who wanted Saddam gone, knew the game was being played, and went along with the lie. One of those politicians was Senator John Kerry, who, as a senior senator on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, knew darn well that no case had been made that Iraq possessed these weapons, but went along because of his own political desires, went along with the notion that Iraq was a threat. He voted for this war, and then he sustained that vote even when it became clear that the intelligence was wrong. He said, if I knew then what I know today, I'd still make that vote. And unfortunately, the vast majority of the American body politic falls into that same cowardly status of putting their personal political gain over what is right and just for the American people.
So you think that was a case of political self-interest for him rather than the fear of being once again labeled as a flip-flopper on political issues?
Well, he, how could he avoid being labeled a flip-flop when he flip-flopped? I mean, he continues to flip on that. No, I believe he actually could have won a great deal of support amongst the American people had he said that he believed the intelligence was wrong, the intelligence was pushed by the Bush administration, it was the Bush administration's responsibility to vet that intelligence before ordering America to war. Therefore, John Kerry should have stood up and said, had I known then what I know today, I would never have voted for this war. Never. And if he had done that, he would have been much more effective than the position he took.
So let's move for a minute just to the role of the United Nations and the international community. You had a piece out today, actually, in The Independent in England about the Oil for Food program, which was the sanctions regime that the UN had imposed. And we've spoken on this show in the past to two of its administrators, including Dennis Halliday, fairly recently. What do you make of the Oil for Food scandal? You said it's a cynical smokescreen in this article. Can you just sum up your thoughts on what's being played out in the media right now on Oil for Food?
Well, first of all, we have Senator Norm Coleman, a Republican, coming out in public saying this is the greatest scandal in the history of the United Nations. It should bring down not only Kofi Annan, but the entire United Nations, that it's a disgrace that Saddam Hussein defrauded his people and the world of billions of dollars of money that he shouldn't have had his hands on. And
now
somehow he leads it open to, because Saddam had done this, the war is justified. How could we ever have talked about doing business with a man who would defraud on this level? The problem with Norm Coleman's positioning is that he's wrong.
In what
sense?
He's
not going to defraud anybody of anything. First of all, it's Iraq's oil, and they're allowed to sell it, under normal conditions, generate income, and spend it as Iraq sees fit. It was the United States that sustained an economic embargo under illegitimate conditions. It was the United States that said, we will never let this embargo be lifted. So the embargo was strangling Saddam. Saddam sought to find ways to generate income that could not be blocked by the United States and therefore allow economic revitalization to occur in Iraq. And he did this. Norm Coleman cannot point to a single instance where Saddam Hussein used money to buy weapons of mass destruction or used money to do anything other than improve the well-being of his nation. There is no scandal. The scandal rests in Washington, D.C. The lies perpetrated by three successive administrations telling the international community, the American people, that the key to the lifting of sanctions rested in Baghdad. All the Iraqis had to do is cooperate with UN weapons inspectors and sanctions would be lifted. We now know that the Iraqis did cooperate fully and completely, that Iraq was totally disarmed by 1996. Verifiably so. And the United States, including the CIA, did whatever was necessary to get the world to look the other way, to get the world convinced that Iraq was lying, to maintain these sanctions at any cost. That is the scandal. The scandal is that it's an American-dominated policy that has killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and no one seems to be taking notice of that.
Well, to be fair, the degree and the levels of cooperation between the Iraqi government and the inspectors varied widely. Towards the end, there appeared to be quite a bit more cooperation than previously, which may explain why the inspections regime was ended, so we'll never know.
To be fair, I would say that now that we can, of course, at the time, as an inspector on the ground, and let's never forget that I was the man who suffered more acts of non-compliance by the Iraqis than the other inspector.
But you're saying yet that they cooperated, so presumably this was after your time.
Now that we know, for instance, in 1996, when the Iraqis failed to cooperate with my inspection, we now know there were no weapons. I think it's fair to say, why weren't they cooperating? And again, I bring up the American policy of regime change. And again, I need to remind you and others that the CIA sponsored no less than five coup d'etat attempts against Saddam Hussein in 1995 with the Iraqi National Congress, in 1996 with the Iraqi National Accord. The 1996 coup d'etat in June 1996 used the United Nations weapons inspectors as a vehicle of facilitation for this coup. And the Iraqis knew this. They penetrated the coup. They knew what was going on. So the Iraqis had a deep distrust of the UN weapons inspectors, especially when the inspectors started moving in on sites in Iraq that were related to the security of Saddam Hussein. Every single major confrontation took place from 1996 to 1998 centered on facilities in Iraq related to presidential security. So I think we need to put it all into a fair balance and not misconstrue the Iraqi noncompliance as somehow being indicative of their desire to acquire weapons of mass destruction.
And of course, the CIA did play a role in Saddam's rise to power in the first place, which, of course, is often forgotten when the tale is retold. I wanted to ask you now about Syria and Iran. There was some stuff flying around on the web that the Iraqis had shipped some of their weapons of mass destruction to Syria, and of course several key figures in the administration were using this to apply pressure on the Syrians. Now, I know you're going to tell me the weapons didn't exist, so they couldn't have been shipped, but what do you make of that story in general?
Well, it's the perfect cover. But I will say that you can't move something that hasn't been built.
Right.
And we now know that nothing had been built, so I'm tired of hearing people talk about moving. But you have many people who still hold on to, many people in positions of power, many congressmen who voted for this war, many senators who voted for this war, who are desperate to legitimize that vote, and they will not accept the reality that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq for several years now. So what they do is hold on to the defense that the reason we didn't find these weapons is that they were moved to Syria, they were moved to Iran, and that these weapons reside in these two nations, and that if we want to complete the task we started by invading Iraq, we need to hold to account those governments that provide safe haven for these hidden weaponry. And that's what we see coming out of Washington, D.C., the shaping of policies on regarding Syria and Iran that are confrontational and are leaning towards potential preemptive military action.
Now, one of the only pieces of documentation that has purported to be evidence of this movement of weapons was a communication between a doctor in Jordan and an Iraqi scientist, there were two versions of the same document, actually, in the same handwriting. Both of them were mistranslated that I saw, and it was describing weapons that were shipped, but there was a lot of problems with it. Now, do you think that The intelligence community has, again, people at mid-level who are aware of how things are happening, but now under Portugal, things are being politicized again. And is there any hope for any kind of accurate understanding on the part of the U.S. public, based on how intelligence is being politicized? Where do we go from here with the CIA?
Well, I don't think the American people understand just how sick the CIA is, even pre-Porter Goss. George Tenet, Deutsch before him, Woolsey before him, all have come together to destroy the credibility of what was once the finest intelligence organization in the world. The CIA, during the Cold War, had a great reputation, a well-deserved reputation for effective intelligence collection, spot-on analysis, and apolitical objectivity. That's all gone now. And we really can't trust anything that comes out of the CIA, because even those officials, the so-called whistleblowers who come out and speak out and provide so-called facts to the public that fly in the face of publicly stated policy, they're politically motivated. They're not acting out of pure intent, so to speak. We're not getting the full story. There's always at least two sides to every story, sometimes many more than that, and it's a good intelligence officer's job to wade through that and try and come up with, the truth. And right now, I think the CIA has lost the ability to search for truth. Right now, their job is to take data and spin it to the political benefit of their masters. And that's not intelligence, that's propaganda.
There was an article today in the Washington Post which describes the U.S. tapping and intercepting phone calls by the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed El-Baradei. Do you think this would be done by the CIA? Would there be another agency that would be involved with that?
Well, the agency primarily responsible for those types of activities is the National Security Agency.
Because it's domestic?
Pardon?
Because it's domestic in the sense that the headquarters is in New York?
Well, the headquarters of the IAEA is in Vienna, Austria.
Mm-hmm.
But the CIA has a special collection element that works with the NSA to do these kinds of tasks. And, it really doesn't matter which agency does it. The fact is, the United States and other nations have been listening to the conversations of high-profile individuals for some time. The phones of every executive chairman I worked for in UNSCOM were tapped by the Americans, the Russians, the British, the Chinese, the French, the Iraqis. It's standard practice. Mohammed El-Baradei should not feel singled out in this regard.
No, I don't think he does. His spokesman today said that they had always assumed that this went on, but they just wished it were otherwise.
But of course you wish it were otherwise, because you wish people would trust you to do the job. The danger is that there's no quality control over this process, especially when you're dealing with a politicized intelligence community. If you're going to talk about the transcripts and discussions of Mohammed El-Baradei, and you're going to condemn him for it, you must release the totality of these transcripts so that the public can see the context in which any given quote was taken. The people who have access to this these intercepted communications have the ability to cut and paste, choose the words they want to use to hang Mohammed El-Baradei, while neglecting or ignoring those words which would mitigate against any negative finding. And it doesn't come down to the fact that people were tapping his phones. That happened. It comes down to how that product will be used. And right now I have no faith in the U.S. intelligence community to do the right thing with that product, which is to tell the truth. I believe Mohammed El-Baradei has shown himself to be an honorable man under very adverse circumstances, and that his actions with Iran are not only correct legally in keeping with his mandate, but also morally in terms of seeking to provide an option other than military action. I think he knows what the United States' ultimate objective is with Iran. I think he knows that this Iranian nuclear program is being used by the United States as justification for massive military action, perhaps as soon as this summer. And so Mohammed al-Baradei is doing whatever necessary without breaking the law, without violating his mandate, but within keeping with the rules of diplomacy, but doing that which is necessary to keep negotiations on track, to hold the Iranians accountable, but not to close the door in a decisive manner, which would only leave one route, that of military action. So he's an honorable man doing an honorable job, and unfortunately we have dishonorable people in Washington, D.C., who view him as a threat.
Now, his communications with Iran presumably have to do with potential military uses for their civilian nuclear program. What legal documents are there, or agreements are there out there, to prevent nations from carrying out military practices and militarization of atomic energy, apart from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty? That's the only treaty that I'm aware of that would actually prohibit a country from carrying out such a thing. What is in it for the Iranians or the Pakistanis or the Indians to not develop these weapons? Why would they not do so?
Well, I mean, ideally you wouldn't do so to prevent incurring the wrath of the rest of the world. Unfortunately, really the only wrath you're incurring nowadays is that of the United States.
But is it not a lesson that, you know, is Iraq not a lesson to other countries since Iraq did not have these weapons, that maybe the way to prevent an invasion that is to develop those weapons?
That's my point exactly. Right now, when you develop these weapons, you're really only incurring the wrath of the United States, which is really the reason why you're developing these weapons, not to incur the wrath, but because the United States does not have sane and rational policies regarding how we interact with the rest of the world. We have the policies of a bully, of an all-powerful bully, who's willing to act preemptively and precipitously whenever we see fit. And the only thing that would prevent that action is if the target of our potential action had the means to inflict horrific harm on us should we choose to act. A nuclear weapon gives you that capability. And Iran, I believe, is developing the mechanisms of a nuclear weapon. I don't believe they have a dedicated nuclear weapons program as we speak, but I believe they are putting together all the pieces so that they could rapidly create a nuclear weapon. You know, Germany did this in the 1960s and 70s. They never violated the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but by the mid-1970s, Germany had the ability to produce a nuclear bomb within 4 months of the political decision to do so, because all they would do is convert their legitimate civilian industry to nuclear weapons work. And the Iranians, I believe, are building a capability on that same model to, A, hold back the United States, but we also have to remember, from their perspective, B, come up with a viable deterrent against Israel. Israel is viewed by almost every nation in the Middle East as an irresponsible nation state that has a foreign policy that's very aggressive, very anti-Arab, and is backed up with nuclear power. And the way many of these nations feel that the only way you can contain Israel's power and irresponsible use of that power is to develop a viable deterrent. The Iraqis were leaning towards that with the development of their nuclear and biological weapons programs, and I believe the Iranians are thinking along those same lines.
And of course, it's widely understood that Israel is the only country in the Middle East with nuclear weapons, as well as being the only country in the Middle East that hasn't signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
And yet they aren't held to account.
Now, what about North Korea? Because that's the final member of the Axis of Evil, so-called, as named by President Bush. What do we know about the state of their weapons programs, and how far along are they? Do we have any clue, even?
Well, I think we have some slight clues that the North Koreans have, in fact, developed a handful of nuclear devices, meaning that if they wanted to drill a hole into the earth and put this device down there, they could set it off and make it go boom. I don't believe the North Koreans have been able to weaponize this, meaning take this device and deliver it, either using an aircraft, an artillery shell, or a ballistic missile. So I don't believe the North Koreans have a nuclear weapon. There's a danger that they could get this, but now we come down to the reality again. A nuclear weapon is a very expensive thing to make, very expensive. And the North Koreans are, teetering on the brink of bankruptcy on a daily basis. They've diverted a significant amount of resources to achieve what they have achieved to date, but they don't have the breakout capacity that Iran has. Iran has a tremendous amount of resources. Iran is a relatively wealthy nation with a well-educated populace that interacts with the entire world minus the United States. So Iran, of the two, when you're talking about a nuclear threat, Iran's the greater threat. Iran's the one that really could, you know, have a breakout scenario, rapidly acquire these weapons and bring them to bear. North Korea, it's the potential of the weapon that causes the unknown. No one's willing to act precipitously against North Korea because of the potential that they might have a nuclear device deliverable to strike Seoul, to strike Tokyo, and...
Well, Scott, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to say thanks for joining us.